Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for the Tech Guy is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com. Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this, my friends, is my Tech Guy podcast. This show was originally heard on the premier radio networks, including 160 or so of the best stations in the U.S., and XM Channel 166 on Sunday, September 4th, 2011. This is episode 802. Enjoy. The Tech Guy podcast is brought to you by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, your Mac, your iPad, your iPhone, or your TV instantly. All streamed directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to netflix.com/twit. Well, hey, a good day to you. Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy. And it's time to talk computers, the internet, cell phones, camcorders, MP3 players, that whole thing, you know, the whole Megillah, the digital technology world we live in. If you want to talk to me, I'd love to hear from you. 888-ASK-LEO is the toll-free number, 888-827-5536. Outside the U.S., you can call that number from Skype out, and it'll still be toll-free. 888-ASK-LEO. And I'd love to hear not only your questions or your calls for help. I used to do a show called Call for Help. I'll take your calls for help, but I'd also like to hear what you think about the news of the day. For instance, you know, a couple of big stories this week. There was a story earlier this week that the U.S. Department of Justice had decided to try to block the acquisition of T-Mobile by AT&T, which would take us from 4 cell phone companies to just 3. And only one of which would offer the GSM-style phone that you need if you want to travel outside the U.S. And the Department of Justice said, that's going to be a monopoly. That's going to be a trust. It's a too big a reduction of competition. We want you to stop it. The judge has to rule, of course. It's not just, you know, they have to go to court. And we'll see what happens. This judge is not, not, I wouldn't say notorious, but is certainly not automatically approving everything the government asks. She turned down a big security merger, or the request the government had to block a big security company merger in 2001. The Comdisco, Sun merger? Government tried to block it. She said, no, there's plenty of competition. And what's more, she said, the barrier to entry in the security business is low enough that we don't have to worry. Now, that's not true of cell phone companies, is it? You can't just come along and say, I'm going to make Leo's cell phone company. I'll put some towers up and bada bing, bada boom. No, not anymore. It's very expensive, very difficult. So I think there's a good reason for the government to say, hey, we ain't getting any more of these. Let's not shrink the number any more than we have to. I did not expect this. I was shocked. I don't think AT&T expected it either, because they had made guarantees to T-Mobile. They had what's called a kill fee, that if the deal didn't go through, T-Mobile would get $3 billion in cash and billions of dollars worth of spectrum and concessions. Whoa. So Deutsche Telekom, which owns T-Mobile, may make out on this one. They probably are saying, hey, yeah, go for it. Sure, you don't get the $39 billion, but you get to keep the company and you get new spectrum allocation. You get a stronger company and a few billion dollars in the bank. So I don't know. Do you think T-Mobile's rooting for this or not? But the big story broke this week, at the end of the week, and a shocker it is. A shocker it is. So apparently, it all started, I think, on Thursday, when CNET reported that an Apple employee had visited a tequila bar in San Francisco. You've heard that song. Tequila. And apparently had maybe one or two shots too many, because that employee on leaving the bar also left behind the new iPhone. The iPhone 5, the one that's supposed to come out in October. Whoopsies. This has happened before, hasn't it? The phone disappeared. And apparently, according to CNET, the San Francisco Police Department launched an investigation. But then the San Francisco Weekly called the SFPD and they said, we don't know anything about it. What investigation? No, sir, we didn't do it. Then, upon a little more investigation, a man came forward, one Sergio Calderon, 22-year-old San Francisco resident. He said, well, five guys came to my door, flashed badges, said they were with the SFPD. I let them in, two of them in, and they searched my place, threatened me, said, is everybody here a legal immigrant? You're running a big risk here, buddy. And left a phone number. SF Weekly called that phone number. It wasn't the San Francisco Police Department. It was the number of a private investigator working for Apple. And now the SFPD says, well, yeah, we did help. Apple asked our help. They said, we think we know where the phone is, thanks to the GPS built into the phone. The SFPD dispatched three detectives to join two Apple private investigators. The detectives took them to the home, knocked on the door. Well, it's not clear who knocked on the door. Gave the impression this was an SFPD investigation, then stood on the curb and watched as Apple's private investigators ransacked this guy's home and threatened him illegally. The SFPD says, quote, Apple came to us saying that they were looking for lost items and some plainclothes officers responded out to the house with them. My understanding, said the spokesman, is that they stood outside. They just assisted Apple to the address. After denying it, the SFPD said, well, maybe we helped a little bit. And you really got to wonder. I mean, Apple's a private company. Do they have the right? For crying out loud, this phone is coming out in a month. It's just a phone. Would you have the right as a private citizen if you left your cell phone in a bar to get three plainclothes detectives to accompany you to the residence of where you thought the phone was so that you could search it? I don't think so. I don't think so. If the SFPD didn't want to treat it as a real crime and send their own plainclothes officers or police officers to the home, maybe get a search warrant, do all of that, then what are they doing? And why are they denying it? Well, I know why they're denying it. It's pretty embarrassing, isn't it? It makes the SFPD look like pets of Apple Computer, doesn't it? Willing to do anything that Apple asks. We got a bit of a scandal here. They did it, then they denied it, then they admitted it. But they said, but we didn't go in. And who are these Apple investigators that are strong-arming this guy? By the way, neither did they find the phone nor any evidence of the phone or any evidence that it's only that it was his, that he'd ever been to this bar. And this poor guy, Sergio Calderon, he said, well, I thought they were the police. That's why I let him in. You didn't have to let him in. You know, you need a search warrant to come in unless there's probable cause. I'm no lawyer, but I know that much. And he certainly doesn't have to let any private citizen or private investigator for Apple into his house to ransack his house. They went through his computers, they went through his stuff, and they threatened him. All because they didn't want anybody to know about their precious iPhone 4 weeks early. Oh, please. This has just gone too far. I'm sorry. That's ridiculous. Just absurd. All right, I'm going to take a deep breath. Take a deep breath. What do you think? I know we're on right now in San Francisco and KGO in San Francisco, the big talk station there. Anybody want to talk to me about it? 888-ASK-LEO. 888-827-5536. Is this appropriate for the police to help Apple in this way? Is it appropriate for Apple to pretend they're the police? And why did they deny it? And then admit it. Sounds like they maybe thought something was a little bit up. You Netflix streaming fan? I am. I love Netflix streaming. Unfortunately, Starz, the Starz Network, which provides a lot of the newer material on Netflix, has already said we're not going to renew in February, 6 months from now, when our contract runs out. That could hurt Netflix pretty badly. Netflix is caught in between, aren't they? On the one hand, you've got the cable companies. And many of us get our internet bandwidth from the cable company, right? But they don't want us to watch movies on that internet bandwidth. They want us to watch movies on their much more expensive video on demand or buy HBO or buy Showtime. They don't want us to watch movies on that inexpensive data connection. That's like buying bits wholesale instead of retail. I don't think they like Netflix all that much. And I suspect they put pressure on other cable companies like Starz not to do business with them. The movie industry is kind of caught in the middle, too, because on the one hand, they'd love the idea of delivering movies to us directly. Don't you think the movie industry would love to get out from under the cable companies and even out from under Netflix and just deliver it straight to us? I'm sure they make more money off Netflix than they do off the cable companies. What a mess. 8888 Ask Leo. You call me. Let's talk. We got a little medley there. Thanks to Kyle Benham. The Tequila Bad Boys medley. The new theme for the San Francisco Police Department. That's good. Mix them together. He's good. Kyle, who is our sound engineer, our board op for the show, does put together a list of all the songs he plays on the show now, which is great. Puts them up on Google Plus, and he puts a link to the Spotify playlist. So if you're Spotify user, this is one of the cool things about Spotify. You can share a link to a playlist, and then if you listen to Spotify, you can hear all the songs, and all at once. We will put that in the show notes, too. Show notes are on our website, techguylabs.com. James DeRuvo is doing a great job. He writes down the stuff I say, the nonsense that spews from my mouth, and puts it on the webpage there so that you don't have to remember anything. If you go to techguylabs.com, you will find other things besides the contents of episode 802, which is what this is, 802. You'll also find a link to our chat room, great place to go if you want to ask questions or just be kind of the kids in the back of the class, 816 people in there right now. And our moderators keep it safe for kids and clean and family friendly, so please don't hesitate to go in there. You won't see anything you don't like, I don't think. That's at techguylabs.com, also a link to the live video, the podcast, downloads of the show, and a whole lot more. Techguylabs.com. But now, let's get to the phones. Mark is in Tustin, California, our very first caller of the day. Hey, Mark, Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
I actually have two Apple questions.
Yeah, sure.
Safari. When I use my IBM and I increase the size of a page by hitting like Control and scrolling up, it stays. But when I do it in Safari for the Mac, every time I do it, I have to then redo it when I restart Safari.
Well, Mac. I guess that's just a design decision that they made differently on Windows and Mac. So, I do the same thing because frequently I'll get to a page. Web pages these days are designed by kids in their 20s. So sometimes the print is like so small that I go, I can't quite read that. So,
and with 27-inch.
Yeah, which is what I'm using, a big screen. You often can't see what's on the screen. So I actually use a similar thing. I do Command Plus to increase the size and Command Minus to reduce it. I'll give you a quick shortcut because it is annoying if it stays at the big size. The way it works on the Mac is it remembers, I think, it's how it works for me, it remembers it per page. So if I've increased the size of a particular page and go to a different page, that next page is at its normal size unless I increase it, and it seems to remember.
In Safari,
I think. Well, I'll tell you what. Let me try it here. So I'm on the Google Plus page. Let's increase the size by Command Plus, and then let's open a new page. Let's go to my website and see, and then that's normal. If I then close Google Plus and then go back to it, let's see what happens. That'll be the test, is if it remembers that bigger size on Google Plus. No, it didn't. So it reverted. Now, the main thing that I found really interesting and useful, Mark, is Command 0 will return any page to its nominal size. So you don't have to press Control minus, 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 Command minus, minus, minus. Just press Command 0 and it goes to the normal size.
Okay.
So that'll help you a little bit. I understand that it's annoying, but that'll help a little bit in terms of getting the page. I presume that the annoyance is you sometimes you don't want it so big.
Well, no. Actually, the annoyance is sometimes I don't want the text to so small. It's a readability thing, so I just simply want it to remember to keep the page size.
Well, you can give it a default zoom level. There is a CSS file. This is a kind of a high-end trick, but if you say, I want it always to be zoomed in a certain amount, is that what you want?
Yep.
This is clever, and thanks to the chat room for pointing this out. It's from Mac OS X Hints, which everybody should know about. What a great site. Now, this is on the Mac, not on Windows. Although
right.
It might work on Windows as well. I don't know. There is, and all browsers now have kind of default templates that they can use. In this case, there's a template that you can create. You'll have to create it. It doesn't exist to begin with, called defaultzoom.css. Actually, you can make it anything you want as long as it has a .css. And you'll put into that some CSS that says the body has a zoom of whatever percent you want. I'll put a link to this in the show notes.
Perfect. Yeah.
And then you save that file and close the editor. And in Safari, you say select a style sheet. And you've probably seen this in the preferences. All browsers do this. You could say, I want to use this as the default style sheet. And that only will change one thing, which is the zoom level.
Right. Perfect.
That way it'll be permanently that way. And they say in this OS X hit, it will work in both Windows and Mac versions of Safari.
Okay.
So I think it would also, by the way, this would also work in any browser that allows you to replace the normal template with a template of your own, a CSS template of your own. And every browser I've ever used, Firefox, Chrome, and Safari, all allow you to do that. So that would be that's a handy little tip if you want a default, you know. I have to say, it really is true. Just a little tip to you kids designing web pages these days. Maybe consider people over 40 who have to use reading glasses. We can't read as well as we used to. So you might think about that text size. For a while, there was this great movement. I think it was kind of a Web 2.0 movement. To have web pages with nice, clear, big, readable text. Not a lot of text on a page. Nice, big, clear buttons. Made for people like us. And then the 20-year-olds came along, and they got great eyesight, right? So they'd use 8-point text, 9-point text. You can also, if you want, in the settings of most browsers, say what the minimum font size should be. I don't want this font ever to be smaller than, 8 points or 9 points or 10 points. I think you could also set that. I think browser designers understand this problem. It's the web page designers that don't seem to. Yeah, it's on the advanced tab in the Safari settings. There's a tab, and I'll zoom into this on the screen for those of you watching. It says, never use font. This is the universal access. Never use font sizes smaller than. You could make this 18 points. And then notice immediately everything gets readable and nice and magical. But do understand, by doing this, you may be breaking some of the design features. Occasionally, a poorly designed site won't reformat its page properly if the text is too big. It'll slide off the edge, or so you may get some unusual, cosmetic issues on web pages. I'm looking at Google Plus. That's a pretty good test. Google is pretty careful about making sure everything works at any size, and Google Plus zooms in quite nicely. I like, and I use all the time, the plus and the minus keys. Command plus to zoom in, command minus to zoom out, and command zero to normalize. That's on the Mac. Dean, South Carolina, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Dean.
Hey, hi, Leo. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Thank you, sir.
I have a problem with my new AirFront Extreme wireless and router. I cannot figure the proper security settings to prevent the exploit with the universal plug-and-play settings.
Ugh, yeah.
Speaking of last week.
Yeah. So this is a just turn it off.
But I don't. They don't even have that. They're using NAT.
No, that's separate. I'll tell you what. We're going to take a break. I'm going to look at the settings on my airport, and I'll let you know what to do. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Turn it up, turn it up, turn it up. Scott Wilkinson is here. He is our home theater guru and expert, the online editor for the Home Theater magazine at hometheater.com. He's also the host of a great podcast, which, if you haven't heard it before, you must listen to, called The Home Theater Geeks. That's live air on my Twit network, Mondays at 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern, live. Actually, I don't have to say live anymore. Just twit.tv. And you can get it after the fact from twit.tv. Hey,
oh,
Scott.
Oh, really? Is twit.tv live now?
Yeah, we redid the website. Go look at it. Brand new website.
I did. I actually went and I looked at the beta.
Yeah.
So it's now up and running.
It's up and running if you go to twit.tv. And when you go there and there's a show on, like this show or your show, there's just a big watch live button that says you can watch it right now. Just press that button.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Excellent.
You know, on live.twit.tv would auto start playing. And I thought that was great. But the problem is with auto start on a website, people don't like it. It makes noise. They may be at their work. They don't want the boss to know they're watching TV. So we let you choose to start it.
Ah, so nice. Choice is always good.
So you have some questions from our listeners, I think.
I do. I have got a question here from Jeff Anderson, who recently bought a new home, and he's got a 12 by 15 and a half foot room in his basement that he wants to make into a home theater, and I think that's a grand idea. The question that he has is, he's not sure if he should put the screen on the 12-foot wall, which would give him more viewing distance, or put it on the wider wall, which would give him less viewing distance. But the problem is he has 8-foot ceilings, so he can't really put a second row behind the first row of seating that's been elevated, which is ideally what you'd want to do. You don't like to have multiple rows of seats at the same level because then you have problems with sight lines, right? The people in the back row can't see through the people in the front row. So he wanted to maybe put a sectional, a couch kind of a thing in the short distance and kind of do it that way. And he could certainly do that. The only question is, will he have the right seating distance? And the answer is yes, because he wants to put in a 100-inch screen. He doesn't say whether he means diagonal. I assume he means diagonal. And if he puts in a 100-inch diagonal projection screen, seating distance is going to be between 11.2 feet, recommended THX viewing distance, and 13.6 feet. Now, he's only got 12 feet in that dimension of the room. So if he puts the couch against the wall, then he would be at just about the perfect viewing distance for a 100-inch screen. Now, there's only one problem with that, which is that putting your seat up against the wall can cause problems with the audio. Because you're right up against that wall, you've got these reflections coming off the wall. It can screw things up a little bit. Plus, if he puts the surround speakers on the far walls, they're pretty far away. I would recommend putting them on stands in that case, kind of in a little bit closer to that couch. So this orientation is not without its problems. He referenced an article that we did. We on hometheater.com, we publish people's installations. Sometimes they're professionally done, custom install home theaters. Sometimes they're DIY projects. And he referenced a one that we did recently where it was exactly that. They put the couch and the screen in the short distance, the short dimension of a rectangular room. The reason they did that was because there was a fireplace at the end of the long dimension of the room, which meant they had no choice. You know, it can work, but I would say it would be better if you could do it in the long dimension. An 8-foot ceiling is kind of low, and raising the second row of seats would be a little bit of a problem. But if you're going to use a sectional anyway and just have one couch in there, it doesn't really matter. So that's my answer to him. If he can do it the other way, it would be better for the sound.
It's really a shame because so often rooms just are poorly designed for setting up TVs. we should just really all build a room just for watching TV.
Well, yes, of course.
Of course. What else you got?
What else have I got here? I got Antonio Marquez asks, he's been listening to me on your show for a while, and we've talked many times about breaking in your plasma, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where you want to give it 100 hours or so, make sure that you're displaying full screen pictures, that is high definition, 16:9, moving images, or static images that are flat gray, that exercise or work all the pixels and all the colors equally for that first 100 hours or so. It's generally a good idea. He found a website that offers the settings to use for this and some images as well. Now, I haven't seen these images. I wasn't able to see them when I took a look here a few minutes ago. But I was a little bit concerned because this website, which is really more of a forum, somebody had posted the settings to use for the break-in period and then the settings to use for after the break-in period. Now, I had two problems with it. One was for the break-in period, they said put the contrast at 100, which is maxed out. And I'm a little uncomfortable with that. I'd rather bring that back a little bit, not to just really flame those pixels.
Okay.
The other problem, and the more important problem, is that this person published the process or the procedure to get into the service menu.
Oh, and that's risky.
That is risky. Now, he did say...
But that's exactly the place you would look to find something like that, to be honest.
Well, no.
That's where I would look. Well, go to a forum. They'll tell you how to do it.
That's exactly right. That's exactly
and I,
right.
And so I hope there's appropriate disclaimers there. But
there
if somebody's
is, there is a disclaimer there. It says, do this at your own risk.
Right. But if somebody's smart enough to be looking for that on a forum, I mean, it's nice that it's published somewhere.
Well, that's true. On the other hand, the Panasonic ST30 and GT30, which are the models that he's asking about, have their white balance controls in the user menu. You don't have to go into the service menu to do it. So I wasn't quite sure why he had published that. We publish our settings, and this brings up a point I wanted to make sure to make here. We do publish the settings that we use on the TVs that we review in the user menu. We do not publish the service menu settings. These days, more and more manufacturers are putting the controls you need to calibrate a TV, even this fancy grayscale calibration, which you shouldn't do unless you're trained and have a lot of expensive equipment.
They're in the regular menu.
They're in the regular user menu.
So the service menu originally was used by installers and people to set it up. And then, of course, it's used if the company sends a service representative over.
Yeah, exactly.
But now you don't. There's really no reason that you need to go in the service menu on most TVs.
No, there really isn't. So I wasn't quite sure why this fellow posted.
Well, I understand. I mean, when you go to a forum like that, the enthusiast forums, I think everything should be published, and you should have access to everything.
As long as there's that disclaimer,
and put
there,
the disclaimer in, and I think anybody
you can really screw things up.
Yeah, but anybody who's searching for something, can you screw things up irrevocably?
No. There's generally a reset button.
Yeah.
That will put it back to its factory defaults.
Well, the good news is you don't need to go into the service menu on most TVs. Everything you would want to configure and calibrate that TV is available from the regular menus.
Exactly right. Yeah. And that's the point I wanted to make.
Geeks like to see what's in the service menu. What is it? I mean, what is in there?
Well, very often it's the grayscale calibration, which is also in the user menu, so I'm not quite sure why they're in two places.
There's not extra stuff.
There is extra stuff. In some cases, there is a timer that tells you how many hours are on the plasma.
Oh, see, that's useful. All that stuff's useful.
That's somewhat useful information.
Just be careful. Scott Wilkinson is the online editor for HomeTheater.com. Catch his podcast at twit.tv. And he joins us every week right here on The Tech Guy. Thank you, Scott.
Thank you.
Want to briefly mention our friends at Netflix, as long as we're talking home theater. What better addition to your home theater could you make? The Netflix streaming. Now, I get it through my Kuro on a Roku box. But newer TVs often have Netflix built in. Blu-ray players. Of course, your Xbox 360, your PlayStation 3, your Nintendo Wii, your iPad. That's a great way. Make your iPad the ultimate personal TV set. And look at all the content. Tens of thousands of movies and TV shows. And I really like the documentaries on here. Stuff that you wouldn't normally be able to find. I just, you know, I like it because I don't have to plan ahead. Fawlty Towers. Wasn't that a great show? John Cleese. Love that. All the episodes on here. So this is the beauty of this. $7.99 a month. The cost of about one VOD movie from your cable company. All of these movies can be yours in high def via your internet connection. Every night I watch Netflix. Every night. I'm going to start The Mad Men. Because, you know, the new season's coming, so I want to go through all of the previous seasons, 1 through 4 first. It's just fantastic. Now, if you're already a member of Netflix, just click that Watch Instantly tab, take a look at it. If you're not already a member, here's what you do. You go to netflix.com/twit, and it's free for 30 days. So you really get a sense of what this would be like. 30 days, unlimited streaming, free. And if you're a Netflix member, you could do me a favor and help support the podcast by telling your friends. Netflix.com/twit. It is simply the best deal in home entertainment. Leo Laporte, it is a holiday. Labor Day weekend, isn't it? Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888 Ask Leo. Our caller right before we went to Scott Wilkinson, our home theater guy, mentioned that he was trying to turn off Universal Plug and Play on his Apple router. Universal Plug and Play is a Microsoft technology that many routers, Linksys routers, Netgear, D-Link routers have. It's right there in the menu, UPnP. And what it does is it's very useful. I'm not going to deny it's useful. It's a major security problem, though. What it does in the router is it allows a program on your computer without notice, warning, or complaint to open holes in your router. Your router provides a very effective firewall against the outside world, because the router is just this dumb box. If it doesn't know what's being requested of it, if a malicious program says, "Hey, let me see your port sharing," there, the router goes, "I don't know what you're talking about," and just drops it. However, this UPnP allows any program, including a malicious program on your computer, to say to the router, "Hey, router, if anybody should ask for port sharing there, just pass it on through to me." And the router, without warning you, without telling you, without complaining, will just do it. Well, you can see the problem here. Malicious software uses UPnP to open up holes in your firewall, basically. It's also used by things like the Xbox. In fact, your Xbox will complain if your router doesn't have UPnP turned on, because the Xbox says, "I'm going to open up my particular ports so that I can set up Xbox Live games." Other programs, Skype and other programs may use UPnP. So it is an inconvenience to turn it off, but it is very important to do so. In fact, it's one of the four things you should do on a wireless router. I mean, on any router. When I get a new router, I do three things to that. I change the password and default router name. I turn off WAN administration. That's administration from outside the network. That's, don't do that. And I turn off UPnP. If it's a wireless router, add that fourth thing, which is to turn on WPA to net encryption. That's all you need to do to secure any router. But it is important. Our caller was asking about how to do it on the, Apple Airport Extreme, and my chat room says, and I believe I remember this to be true, that actually Airport Extreme doesn't use UPnP. It uses a different technique, PMP, which is safer. And so you don't need to turn off UPnP, because there is no UPnP. That's why you can't find that setting. That's why you don't have that setting. It's just Apple doesn't use UPnP. That's a Microsoft technology. So, and as far as I know, there's no NAT PMP exploits. This isn't open to the same kind of exploits. And .Mac uses it and so forth. It's called the NAT Port Mapping Protocol, or NATPMP. And actually, I'm thinking it's off by default anyway. Yeah, I think it's off by default anyway. So you're even safer. Don't worry about it. We're going to take a break, come back with more. Lots of great callers on the line. Rick from Moreno Valley, you're next. He has a Nikon, but when he emails his photos, they're too big. How does he make them little? I'll tell you. Moreno Valley, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Rick.
Hi, Leo.
Welcome to the show. What can I do for you?
Thank you very much. I sent some of my photographs to friends. A couple of them wrote back saying that the photos were extremely large in the email.
Are you doing anything to process them before you email them? No.
My VCR is still blinking midnight.
So what happens is you take pictures on your nice camera. You copy the data from your camera's memory onto your hard drive.
Right. Yeah,
and then you say, "Oh, I got to send this to Bill."
So
you say, Bill, and you start an email to Bill, and then you press the paperclip, and you attach the copied file over. But that's a, on a modern camera, that's probably 10 megabytes or more.
Okay.
Do you remember the old days when 10 megabytes was your entire inbox?
In
fact, it's not just the old days. Still on some internet service providers, that's all you get. So it's not polite, it's rude to send a 10 megabyte file. You could actually fill up somebody's inbox with one email. So here's what we do. There's two choices. My preferred choice is not to send attachments of any kind. Attachments are potentially dangerous. And I try to train all our listeners not to open attachments. So Bill, when he gets your email, if he's been listening to me, he's going to say, "Oh, I know it says it came from Rick, but maybe it's a bad guy pretending to be Rick. I'm not going to open this." So
right. You
could do this, if you use and everybody should be using a program like, let's say, Picasa, which is free. There are a lot of programs where you import your pictures. It allows you to browse them. And Picasa, PICASA.com.
Oh, yes. I've paired with that when I store some of my photos.
It's great. So it stores it on your hard drive. You can upload them to Picasa Web. But it also has a button that says email this picture. And what it does, it will shrink it down. You get to change the settings. But the default settings will shrink it down to a manageable size, a few hundred kilobytes, so that your friend Bill can see it. But it doesn't jam his inbox. But still, I would prefer that you use your program like Picasa Web to upload and then send Bill a link.
Okay.
It's safer. And what you could do is have a whole album now of all the great pictures you took from that fishing trip. And instead of sending those pictures individually, I've been trying to, by the way, I've been trying to train my wife to do this for years. She still sends attachments. I set the VCR in our house. But if you can, it's better to send a link to a folder, because then it's easier for your correspondents. It's safer because they know, it's photos only. It just seems to me a better way to do it. Now, people are using Facebook to
browse the photos and everything.
Yeah, exactly. They're using Facebook. I use Google Plus, really has a nice photo sharing feature. Picasa Web is free. Up to, I think, 2 gigabytes. Microsoft has its own photo sharing service. It's excellent. So if you use Windows, there's a great choice there at live.get.live.com. There are a lot of good choices which don't require you to attach files and send them.
Okay, on the camera itself, there's a setting for image size. Now, the top one says 12M. What does that mean?
That's okay. So that means that when you use the full quality, which you should use, there's no reason not to, you're going to get a 12-megapixel picture. That means about 12 megabytes.
Yeah, because the camera's 12.1.
Yeah, so that's full. But you want to don't lower the quality of the picture you take just so you can email it. Take a full-quality picture, put it on your hard drive, and then lower the quality before you email it.
Gotcha. Okay.
Because you want to have that picture look as good as it can.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, what if you blow it up, what if you want to make a billboard? But I think it's really nice to use these tools. Like Picasa is a great one because it's free. Of course, there's Photoshop Elements, which is really great, under $100 from Adobe, and that has a lot of additional features. But that has a photo album feature. It's called Album. There on the Mac, of course, you have iPhoto, comes with the Mac. If you're using Windows, Windows Live Photo sharing is great. So a lot of ways to do this. It's almost professionals do this. Amateurs should do it too, because we all take a lot of pictures these days. Even if you're only using your camera phone, import the pictures into a program like Picasa Web. Review them, delete the ones you don't like, clean them up if there's red eye, or if you want to crop it and crop out the telephone pole and just have the image of the lake, things like that. Make it look good. And then all of these programs have a button that says email this picture, as well as the ability to upload the best pictures to the internet, where you can share them with friends and family. And by the way, speaking of backup, they're safe. They're backed up. Thanks for the call. I appreciate it, Bill. Leo Laporte. Rick. His friend's Bill. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Well, a good day to you. How are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Great to see you here. 8888 Ask Leo is the number if you want to call in. I'd love to talk to you. 888-827-5536. Tell you what, I can't remember the number, but you don't have to, and I don't have to, because you just go to the website, techguylabs.com, and you'll find everything there, including the number to call, our chat room, show notes, audio and video. It's all there. techguylabs.com. 8888. Ask Leo is the phone number. Let's see. We were mentioning Netflix last hour and the fact that they were getting a little squeezed by the movie industry, by the cable companies, the internet service providers. According to New TV on GigaOm, a great blog for tech information, GigaOm.com, Dish Network could soon be taking on Netflix in subscription streaming. See, Dish bought Blockbuster. Now, I don't know if there's a Blockbuster store in your neighborhood. I think they all got closed, didn't they? Are they still around? Well, maybe they are. does anybody go to the movie store anymore? See, Netflix really threatens those guys. Get the DVDs by mail or the streaming. Well, according to GigaOm, next month, Dish is going to roll out a Blockbuster streaming video service that would complement their existing online video on demand and DVD by mail services. Did you even know that they did that? I didn't. Actually, I did. I tried Blockbuster for about a minute. They had some sort of free trial a couple of years ago, and I gave up. I said, no, I like Netflix. I'm sticking with it. There was all sorts of weirdness about it. Be interested to see if Stars, one of the reasons Stars is leaving Netflix is perhaps it's moving over to this, I don't know, Blockbuster competitor. That would be interesting. Blockbuster is apparently trying to take advantage of the fact that Netflix raised its prices last month. And a few Netflix customers are a little upset, even threatening to quit. But where you go, there's nothing really, there's no big alternative, and maybe this is the option or the opening that Blockbuster Dish has been looking for. Be interesting to see what happens there. This is a very volatile space, as I mentioned, because, you know, everybody wants their stake. The only people who don't get what we want are us. Frankly. We're the ones who lose out as these big giants. When dinosaurs fight, you don't want to be the little person at their feet. They squish you. They squish you. Microsoft, we were talking about Apple and, you know, their kind of shenanigans with the iPhone 5 and the San Francisco Police Department. Well, Microsoft's not exactly blameless either. Remember Apple was got in trouble because people found out that their iPhones had a file on it that showed kind of where you'd been for the last few years. This file, which could be downloaded and hacked, and it concerned people reasonably. Apple responded by saying, oops, we didn't mean to save that data, and we're going to delete it. And we apologize. Microsoft had the same problem with Windows Phone 7. In fact, Microsoft even really made it worse by publishing that data accidentally online so that anybody could see it. They responded by saying, oh, you know, they took the data offline and customers can opt out of their location reporting program. You've seen that on most phones. Phones will ask you before they say, you know, they say things like the Google phones, the Android phones, for instance, say, we'd like to collect location data. What they're doing in most cases is matching up Wi-Fi access spots that you can see with your phone, with your GPS location, so they can make a database that says, hey, if you can see these Wi-Fi access spots, you're probably here. So there's a commercial company called Skyhook that does this. They drive cars around. Google's been doing it with their Google street mapping cars as well. This database is very useful because if a phone doesn't have GPS or GPS is turned off, it can still kind of say where you are, not as accurately as GPS, but within a block where you are, but based on what Wi-Fi access spots you can see. Not ones you can join, not even ones that are necessarily open, just the fact that you can see them. So when you carry around your smartphone, if you've opted into this, it's logging where you are all the time and sending that information back to the mothership along with open access spots or Wi-Fi access spots that you can see. Well, it turns out that Microsoft, which said, well, you can opt out of this, apparently opting out doesn't do anything. Wednesday, a Michigan woman filed a class action lawsuit claiming that she and other Windows Phone 7 users have opted out, and it still is reporting their movements to Microsoft. Cancel apparently does not prevent Microsoft from gathering the data. Oh, dear. I just got to underscore this. If you are carrying around a smartphone with GPS and Wi-Fi built in, unless you turn off the radios, the GPS and the Wi-Fi, and just use it as a phone, you should just assume that it's beaconing at your location to anybody who wants to know. Similarly, if you post something on the internet, you should just assume that at some point it could become public. I think people have a false sense of security and privacy with this stuff. If you post something on the internet, even if it says it's private, even if Facebook says we'll never share this, think of it as public. That'd be safest. Maybe it'll stay private, maybe not. And if you carry around a phone with a GPS built into it, unless you actively turn off that radio, which you can do in all phones, of course you won't get any location services, but if you turn that off, then nobody will know where you are. And it's not just Microsoft or Apple or Google that's keeping track of where you are. Law enforcement can very easily, without a warrant, ask your phone company, hey, where's Leo right now? And the phone company will, for a buck or two, tell them. No warrant needed. So if you're carrying around one of these things, you might just keep that in mind. People know where you are. It doesn't bother me. I check you. I use Foursquare and Google Latitude, all these check-in services. I announce where I am all the time. I'm not hiding anything. But then again, I'm not, you know, people aren't stalking me. I'm not worried about people following me around. But I think that there's quite reasonably many people might be nervous about that. If you give your kid a phone with a GPS, you can track them. So I guess the bad guy's good too. I do that all the time. Shh, don't tell my kids. But if I want to know where my kids are, you know, it's 11 o'clock. Do you know where your kids are? Yeah, actually I do, because they have iPhones and I just look on the internet and it says right where they are. 8888 Ask Leo. Bob in San Diego, you're our next caller. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi, Leo. I just have a question on the security with the new Yahoo Mail program.
They've had a lot of trouble lately, haven't they?
Well, yeah. Possibly. You go to this page that has, multitudes of information on the new system that you have to read through like a lawyer, you know?
Right.
And yeah, what's your thoughts on this new system? I know the classic has been fine, but the new system...
it's not. I wouldn't say it's any less secure than the old system was. The problem with Yahoo Mail in general is that it's apparently, for some reason, it's pretty easy to hack, because that seems to be the mail service that most people are getting their passwords stolen or hacked. Maybe that's because a lot of less sophisticated users use Yahoo Mail. I like Yahoo Mail. I use Yahoo Mail. The new Yahoo Mail is merely a move to HTML5. I wouldn't treat it as, somehow less secure or more risky, regardless of what the – I haven't read – let's be honest. Does anybody read those user licenses that they flash on the screen, the 24 pages of lawyerese that they say you have to agree to before you sign up? Your problem, Bob, is you read it, and now you're terrified.
I read part of it. It says, by using the service, you consent to Yahoo's automated systems to scan and analyze.
Yeah, let me explain what they do, and Google does, and everybody else does, and when we come back. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Heating up. As we hit Labor Day weekend, I hope it's hot where you are and warm or sunny and nice and good for your barbecue and all of that. 8888 Ask Leo, that's the phone number. Good question from our last caller. And it's a category of questions that I want to, or category of concerns that I want to cover. In the new user license agreement for Yahoo Mail, I suspect it was there before, but nobody read it. So it was when you upgrade to the new Yahoo Mail, you are displayed this EULA, this end user license agreement, and asked to read it and accept it. And of course, nobody does. You see these pop up all the time on everything, and I just go, yeah, whatever. My philosophy is, if there's an issue, I know somebody, you know, some blogger or somebody in the press will, or Leo will read it and let me know. But very frequently, these legalese documents scare people. And then sometimes bloggers like to play on that because it's good for links. And so let me explain what's going on. Yahoo says, we require that if you agree to use our email system, you allow our automated systems to scan your email. Well, of course. Do you have anti-spam protection? Anything that's searching for spam has to scan your email, right? It's looking at the email to see what's in it so it can decide whether it's spam. So any email system that you use that has anti-spam, whether it's on your computer or on the internet, including Gmail, Yahoo Mail, and Hotmail, scan your email. That's what they have to be able to do that. Now, Gmail has gotten a lot of hint. In fact, Microsoft, it's ironic because Microsoft made a very kind of funny video about the Gmail man who's reading all your mail before he delivers it to scare people, without really pointing out that, in fact, Hotmail does exactly the same thing. It has to, or it wouldn't be any good for spam. How would they tell if it's spam if they didn't read your email? Now, Google's very clear. In fact, if you sign up for Google's Gmail, they'll give you a very good, I think, and very fair explanation of what they do in Gmail. They do scan your email for two reasons. I suspect Microsoft and Yahoo do it for both reasons as well, but I don't know. Gmail certainly admits it and explains it. Not merely to scan for spam, but also when they're scanning that email, they look for keywords so that they can give you advertising that's associated with the emails you read. The idea being, if you're getting a lot of email about your fishing trip, perhaps you'd be interested in some fishing gear, and so that ad will pop up. They call it contextual advertising. Gmail or Google has done it for years on websites. That's how Google ads work on websites. You notice that the ads on the websites usually relate to the content of the website. A lot of people don't like this. I understand you don't have to use Gmail if it bothers you, but you're getting a free service. It's an advertising-supported service, and it works that way. My opinion is you shouldn't be concerned about it. It's exactly the same procedure, technology, and computers reading your email that read it for spam. These are automated systems, not humans. No human is reading your email. It's a computer looking for keywords. In fact, if you've seen the ads you get on Gmail, it's not even doing that good a job. It doesn't understand what it's reading. It makes mistakes. It doesn't bother me in the least. This is the deal you do. If you don't want spam, if you want any spam filtering, or you want a free email system that's paid for by advertising, this is the deal you do. Don't worry about it. You'll also see sometimes people worry about language on Facebook or Google Plus or other social networks saying things like, we reserve the right to copy, transmit your content, to preserve copies of it, to transmit it, to copy it elsewhere. Often they even say more aggressive things like to use it in any situation, in any circumstance, now or ever to be invented, known, or here or now and worldwide and planetary-wide around the universe and things like that. That's just legalese. Lawyers like to protect themselves. In almost every case, what those clauses mean is in order for us to have web servers that serve your Facebook photos and your Facebook content, we need to have more than one computer keeping a track of it. We have copies of it on multiple servers. We have the right and need the right to move your data around so that we can serve it. It's just part of the deal. Then, of course, Facebook's lawyers, trying to keep them out of trouble, write it in such a way that it covers them for all possible circumstances. It's really, these terms of services are very normal. I have yet to see one that, while they're sometimes scary, these companies are not interested in spying on you. They can't. Facebook has 750 billion users. Mark Zuckerberg could, and I suppose there's no, you can't prove the negative. You can't prove they're not, just kind of browsing through people's accounts looking for dirty pictures. It's possible that they are. But most of the time, what I believe is happening is this automated scanning looking for keywords. So Facebook knows your age, location, gender, marital status. You give them all that stuff, and they absolutely, and they say it, use this for advertising. If you want to buy an ad on Facebook, you could say, I want this ad to only appear for married women ages 35 to 45 who live in Upper New York State. And Facebook will sell you that. How do they know that? Because you told them. And you give them permission to use that information. Does that mean they're spying on you? I don't think so. But again, I should point out that when you put something on the internet, even if it's email, you should assume that it is public. Whether it's a picture on Facebook, even if they say, no, no, this is private, only you can see it. Assume that it could get public somehow. And never, and kids, this is important for you, never post anything online that you wouldn't want family, friends, teachers, parents, or future employers to see. Because there's no promise that they won't. And if you're worried about, if you're writing stuff in email that you don't want people to see, remember, email is just like a postcard. You wouldn't write something totally private on a postcard and pop it in a mailbox. Anybody who sees that postcard could read the other side. That's what email's like. Any server, and there are many that every email goes through, can read your email because it's just like a postcard. It's in plain text. It's readable. And you don't, you or Google or Yahoo or nobody else controls what servers that mail goes to. The way the internet's designed, that mail could go to any variety of places that you don't control. Just look at your headers of your email to see where that email has been, what servers it's lived on. Every one of them can make a copy of it, read it, and know more about it. So if you want privacy on the internet, you probably should be encrypting your email using strong encryption with passwords only you know. Because then it's like sealing it in an envelope. It's better than sealing it in an envelope because nobody can read it without those passphrases. So think of email as a postcard. Anybody can read it. Of course you're giving Yahoo permission to read it. Otherwise, they wouldn't be able to do spam filtering. And I'm not sure, but I suspect both Yahoo and Microsoft in their mail programs also look at keywords in the same way Gmail does to give you contextual advertising. Hey, it's a free service. 8888 Ask Leo. That's how it works. Nothing to be worried about. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. If you could read my mail, love. We'll have to rewrite that Jim Croce song. If you could read my mail. Of course they can read your mail. And of course they are reading your mail. But not humans. You know, I got to point out that the same thing could happen with a phone call, right? I mean, you make a phone call. And it's impossible to prove that the phone company's not listening in or national security agency. Now, the difference is that there are laws that make it illegal for people to snoop on phone calls. They have to have a warrant to do so. It has to be a police agency. The phone company can't just pick up the line and listen. There's no way to prove they're not doing it, but it would be illegal to do so. We don't, unfortunately, have the same kinds of protections in electronic communications. For example, if you are sending email or at work, the boss can read it all. It's against the law for the boss to listen to a phone call as soon as it's private. So let's say you're at work, you pick up the phone and you're calling and you're talking to the doctor about the latest test results. Now, the boss can pick up the phone and listen in. That's legal. But he's required by law, as soon as you say something of a personal nature, to hang up. Can't listen. The same email, if you had that email with your doctor, the boss not only can read it, he can do anything he wants with it. He owns the computer systems. And anything you do at work is owned by the company and can be that you can be spied upon, snooped upon in any way without notice electronically. It's just phones that are protected. So it's important, I think, that people, I think, there's a certain amount of shock when people find this out. So I want to spread the word. And I think kids especially need to know stuff you put on the internet. Just treat it publicly. Just treat it as public. That's all. That solves it. Val is calling from, is it Pinon Hills, California?
It's Pinion Hills.
Pinion Hills. Hi, Val.
Hey, I've got some problems. I'm on dial-up. Windows XP, and on Thursday my computer was working fine, slow but fine, and yesterday it was being worse than slow. I went back to a restore point, and that cleared it, so I was able to go on to the internet, And when I got there, my favorites bar was gone, and in the midst of everything I was doing to try and get that back, I went to the point where I couldn't even get the screen for the internet up.
Right.
It logs in, it comes up, and then it flashes off, and I go back to my desktop.
So you got infected.
I got what?
You got infected.
I got a second?
You got infected. Bad guys got into your computer.
Oh, no, I've got Nod 32.
Well, okay, that's good. Maybe you didn't get infected. You've been keeping it up to date?
Yeah, but I don't have the Service Pack 3, which it says is a critical update.
Oh, yeah. Now, I got to tell you, an antivirus can only go so far to protect you against yourself. If you don't have updates in your operating system, what that means is there will be flaws in the operating system that a bad guy can exploit to gain control of your system. So it is, and unfortunately, a good antivirus like Nod 32 watches for those kinds of things. That's what we talk about as the heuristics. Heuristics, you know, there's two ways an antivirus works. One is it scans for virus pieces on your hard drive, and it does that by searching your hard drive. It has a database, we call it the signature database, of data that is typical of a virus or particular to a specific virus. And there's hundreds of thousands of viruses, so this signature database is large, and of necessity, these signatures can't be too big, otherwise it would be really large. So they have maybe, I don't know, 20 bytes of data that is typical of a particular virus that would be in that virus data. And so they can scan your drive, and if they find a match, they say, hey, well, you know, this matches. It's highly unlikely that this random string of 20 characters that belongs to this virus would match something that's not the virus. That's a false positive. It does happen. But we are worried about this file. So that's one thing. The other thing, the heuristics is actually a fine art. It's the antivirus is running on your system at all times, is looking for virus-like activity, and modify a system file and things like that. What it sounds like has happened to you is that at some point, and normally this would require action on your part, you downloading and running a program. But because your Windows is not updated, it could be that without any cooperation on your part, a bad guy could exploit this vulnerability on your system and do it without your knowledge or permission. But they can modify, if they modify your system and get something on your system and Nod 32 doesn't catch it, now you're infected. And Nod 32 may not see it as a virus. For instance, and I suspect this is what's happened, you probably have something called a browser helper object that has modified your browser's behavior. The browser helper object is often used by bad guys to do things like change your homepage to their page or to redirect your browser in certain cases. Sometimes if the bad guy's really malicious, he'll keep you from going to antivirus sites because he doesn't want you to figure out you've got a virus or what to do about it. They can do that by modifying your host file. Now, here's the problem. Nod 32 can try to block this, but it is not unusual for a legitimate program to make these modifications. Nod 32 doesn't, no security program wants to shut down your capabilities. They want to monitor it and look for suspicious stuff and warn you. But there's a fine, you know, there's a balance between warning you about everything or warning you about nothing. It wants to warn you about true virus activity, but not give you problems. So it may have warned you, maybe not. It might have looked to Nod 32 like you were modifying your browser in a completely normal way, adding an extension, putting a toolbar on there, a browser helper object. Many programs legitimately use these BHOs. So Nod 32 either maybe didn't see it, or maybe you did get a warning. Maybe user access control from Windows popped up and said, do you want to make this change? And you clicked, yeah, go ahead. Maybe because unfortunately we're kind of conditioned to say, yeah, go ahead. Please, would you? I don't want to. I'm not interested. I don't want to know. So I think that what you just described is pretty suspicious. Your system got very slow, often a sign of malware. You rolled it back to a system restore point, and now your browser is kind of funky. Sounds like files in your browser were modified. I don't know exactly what to do here. I think the best thing to do probably is to reinstall Windows and get that Service Pack 3 on there. Why didn't you put Service Pack 3 on there in the first place? Was there something? Is it preventing you from installing Service Pack 3? Val?
Hello?
Yeah, why didn't you put that on there in the first place?
Service Pack 3 is huge. It took me 3 hours to download IE8.
Oh, you're on dial-up. Are you on dial-up?
Yes. We have no DSL out in this area that I can get.
This is a real problem. I agree with you. Microsoft has made these updates so big that people don't want to do them.
Well, I would be glad to do it if they'd send me a CD.
$3.
Okay. And what's the phone number?
I don't know, but I think you could probably find it on the web. I'll get the phone number for you. The chat room will get it for me. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. So we were talking with Val about her problems, her virus. I think virus problems, although you never know. I mean, it could be a hard drive issue. You know, if your hard drive has difficulty reading a particular sector, and that sector happens to be that part of Internet Explorer that, you know, you needed for the toolbar, well, then you could also have the same result. But this is very consonant with virus activity. So I would treat it like malware. The phone number to go to get Microsoft, to get updates from the Microsoft on CD, because you're on dial-up and you can't take the time to download it, according to NorCal, is 800-360-7561. 800-360-7561. We'll put that in our show notes. James is writing that down, I'm sure, right now, at techguylabs.com, Val, so you could get it there. You got Nod 32, but you got... So, protecting yourself against malware on Windows, certainly it's a good idea to have a security program, but you also need to do some other things. Really important that you apply every Windows update that's out there. And I know on dial-up, that's a pain because they're big, but that's the way it is. It's really important because if you don't, you're not fixing a hole that a bad guy now knows about because of Microsoft's update, a hole that allows the bad guy to get into your system without your knowledge or permission. You really don't want that. You also have to be careful and proactive, even if you do all your updates, about falling for social engineering tricks. Bad guys are particularly good at these days. A social engineering trick might be, for instance, popping up a spurious warning that you have a virus that looks just like maybe Microsoft is telling you. You know, sometimes it says antivirus 2010. And it says, oh, man, there's a virus. Quick, click this button and download the fix. And if you do that and you run that program, well, it's not a fix. It's a virus. That's called social engineering. They tricked you by engineering you and your expectations, by conning you. Other social engineering tricks involve phishing scams where they send you an email that looks like it came from your bank that says, quick, somebody's broken into your account. You need to log in and change your password. Sends you a page that looks just like your bank. You log in. You think nothing happens. Bad news. That wasn't the bank. That was a hacker who now has your bank's password. Or on Facebook, you get a wall message from a friend that says, oh, man. You got to see these pictures I took of you last night. Or I got some great video of you last night. You won't believe it. And you go, what? What did I do last night? Oh, my gosh. And you get freaked out, right? Social engineering often requires or uses tricks to get you to stop thinking, not use your normal cynical self to say, now, wait a minute. I wasn't out last night. No, you go, oh, my gosh, what has he got? And you click the link and it takes you to a page that looks like YouTube and it says, oh, wait a minute, you can't see the video. You don't have the latest flash. And you go, I got to see that video. What did I do last night? So you say, but yeah, download the latest flash. And you download the latest flash and you put it on your system, except it wasn't flash. It was the bad guy who got you to run a program on your system that infected you. That's social engineering. And frankly, it's the most common way now that they have to get at you. They send you an email with an attached file that says, oh, you won't believe these pictures of Anna Kournikova. And you say, hubba hubba, and you open them, and it's not what they are. And, you know, because Microsoft's been so good lately at patching all the flaws that they find in Windows right away, every second Tuesday of the month, they put out those patches. Bad guys have realized that the best way to attack Windows machines now may not be attacking Windows itself, but attack some of the programs on Windows. So of late, they've been attacking Flash. They've been attacking Adobe Reader, MP3 players, JPEG viewers, things, you know, Microsoft's own JPEG viewer, so that they can get in there and get around the fact that you've been keeping your system up to date. So it's not just your system. You want to keep all your files up to date as best you can to avoid that. Patrick, Anchorage, Alaska, you're next. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Patrick.
Hey, Leo. Wow, it's been a while. I haven't called. First time caller, first time listener, soon to be long time listener.
Good.
Hey, yes, I'm calling in regards. I'm wanting to get into independent filmmaking, and I've tried the trial versions of Adobe After Effects and Sony Vegas Pro and things like that. But they're also complicated. I have a real hard time using them. I'm not into computers, software of that nature. I mean, I can build a computer manually, but I can't program worth beans. So I'm trying to find a more easy to use.
None of it's easy to use. You got to learn it all, baby.
Mm-hmm.
After Effects is the king of the hill on this stuff. If you're using a Mac, of course, Apple's got Motion, which is excellent. These programs are the programs you'll probably need to use. Special effects are difficult. It's like saying, I want to be a musician, but I don't want to learn how to play the piano. Sorry. You got to learn this stuff. Now, here's the good news. You can learn it. You totally can learn it. It's just initially these are much more complicated than your word processor, your browser, or your email program. Of course, they're doing a lot more. And you really don't want a special effects program that's just one button push and it does it automatically. That's like those photo programs, you know, you automatic enhance. You press the magic wand button and it fixes it. Yeah, that's fine as far as it goes, but you don't want your effects to look cookie cutter like everybody else's. So I mean, there are, you know, I have to say there are easy to use programs. SPFX in our chat room, who's obviously a special effects guy, says FX Home is easy to use. But I got to think that anything that's easy to use is not going to be very interesting or very powerful or very useful. I love Vegas. I love After Effects. These are good. He says FX Home, fxhome.com is easy to use, might be worth it a look, see if this is something that does what you want. And maybe the best thing to do is to use something that's easy like this. It might be easy to use, but it's not easy to buy. It's a few hundred, $679, okay, for the whole thing. But I hope they have a trial. They probably do. But, you know, maybe you learn to use this and then you get the idea and you can move to a more advanced program. I would go to lynda.com. I know they're a sponsor, but I've been recommending them for a long time, even before then. lynda.com. And look at their training for After Effects. They're small little videos, you know, 10 minutes, 8 minutes. They're quick. They get very good trainers. They're mostly people I know and admire and respect. And they really can help you learn how to do this stuff. And I think you want to learn how to. I really believe you want to learn it. If you're serious about doing special effects, don't use an amateur toy. Hit Film Ultimate, don't know that one, but I'm getting some good chat room recommendations. Shorty says videocopilot.net has some good tutorials for After Effects. Actually, I think those Video Copilot series is pretty good. Is that free? They're not free, but or are they? Maybe they are. Videocopilot.net. Spend the time. If you really want to do these After Effects, these special effects, learn them. Learn them, because it really will help. Creative Cow, that's free. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. More to come right after this. Well, a good day to you, Leo Laporte here, the tech guy, hour number 3 of the Tech Guy Show. Talking about computers and the internet and cell phones and camcorders and MP3 players and home theater and all that jazz. 888 Ask Leo. That's the phone number, 888-827-5536. Anywhere toll-free from the U.S., outside the U.S., still toll-free. But you'll have to use Skype or something like that to call that toll-free number. 1-888-827-5536. Let's get back to the phone. I want to get as many calls as I can. I know I'm slow sometimes answering the calls, so let's see how many we can get through on the line this hour. I do want to remind you the website is techguylabs.com, and for Val and all the people who called last hour and the hour before and got an answer, if you didn't write it down or you couldn't remember it or I said it too fast, it's on the website, techguylabs.com, along with links to our chat room, which is always fun. I think we got 1,000 people in there. Yeah, we broke 1,000 today, as we have a lot lately. That's the max, and we spawn a second room and a third room. So there's always plenty of room. Come on in. You also find the link to the live video and live audio and the podcast and all that stuff. TechGuyLabs.com. Scott, Las Vegas, you're next. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hey, Leo, how you doing today?
I am well. How are you, sir?
Well, I'm pretty good if I get through this issue that I've got going on here.
Okay.
I'm working on my Mac Mini 10.7 Tiger. I'm using Final Cut Pro 10. And I've exported a file out to an SWF file, and I want to play it on my company website, my Mac, the videos. And I spent about 9 to 10 hours on this issue, and I'm still stuck in the same position.
Well, I hope I can help you. SWF is a flash format, so Final Cut 10 will automatically export to SWF. That's good, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And I guess what my question is twofold. Is Flash a better format to use on the web than
no?
QuickTime?
Well, what is better? What does better mean? If the problem with Flash, of course, is that no Apple device will play it, so you're going to leave iPad and iPhone users out. In fact, most mobile devices, even if they will play Flash, and Android does, don't play it well. Flash is a very heavy video format; uses a lot of CPU. And so it's not ideal for mobile devices. On the desktop, almost everybody has Flash, so you don't have to worry so much about that. Although lately, problems cropped up with the latest versions of Windows. By default, the 64-bit versions of Windows launch Internet Explorer 64-bit, and what? There's no 64-bit Flash. So people who are browsing around with IE 8 or 9 on 64-bit Windows will find suddenly Flash stops working. They have to know enough to launch the 32-bit version of Internet Explorer, and then they can see the Flash sites. And I think what you're seeing is that Flash, people are moving away from Flash. The advantage of Flash is on the desktop, almost everybody can do it. You can export from Final Cut into a format like QuickTime, for instance. QuickTime, the native format, .mov, you put that on your web page, then people are going to have to download a QuickTime player. They're going to have a plugin for it, and that's kind of annoying. This is why we're really pushing, YouTube's doing this, and a lot of other companies are doing this, to a standard called HTML5. It's the next standard for web pages. And we're hoping that the folks who ratify the HTML5 standard will also ratify a video codec, because that's what we're talking about here, a video codec, that every browser will support it, and then we won't have to think about this ever again.
Right.
But we do. So what you have to think about is, who is your audience? You said it's for your company?
We do legacy video.
You know all about these codec issues then. I mean...
In fact, that's why I spent so much time on it. I've got it to work, but it just, the latency on it. I had a Flash file that actually works, but it takes like 5 minutes to load, and my audience is going to go away.
Yes. I wonder if that's because it's so big.
It's a 6-minute video, and then I ran a compression on it, but then it looks like junk when it plays. I have a there who's doing the same thing, but you know they clearly know what they're doing, whereas I'm just still trying to figure out what it is I need to do.
Boy, I'm not the guy to ask about optimizing Flash videos for quick playback. I don't know off the top of my head. And maybe I wouldn't be surprised if QuickTime or Final Cut 10 doesn't do a great job. You know what? Here's what I would do. This makes it much easier for you. Export out a high quality movie. You know, a good looking, even if it's 1080p, a good looking high quality movie, and then upload it to YouTube, or maybe if you really want quality, Vimeo, V-I-M-E-O. And what the advantage is, both YouTube and Vimeo will take that high quality movie file, QuickTime movie, convert it to something that plays back on HTML5 and Flash. They'll convert it to optimize it. Their servers will do a good job of, I think, delivering it. And you'll get the best results. A lot of photographers use Vimeo for their high-def videos because Vimeo has high-def built in and it looks really good. Vimeo.com. And then on your webpage, instead of embedding the SWF file, you'll use the embed command, or better yet, the object command, which is more modern, to point to the Vimeo source, and it will play from Vimeo. Vimeo will actually give you the embed code, and you'll get a much better result.
Yeah, that's what I originally did with my... I put QuickTime up there, and instead I decided to use YouTube, and I just pointed to the YouTube
right.
page.
YouTube's okay, but it doesn't necessarily give the... It depends on who's seeing this. For instance, YouTube comments are pretty annoying. You get the YouTube ads on top of it and so forth. I would pay a very small amount, I don't remember what it is, for a Vimeo Pro account. You don't get any ads. They play back the video, very high quality. They make it compatible with the iPad as well as other devices. And they do it all automatically for you.
Okay, I'll do that.
That's so much easier, Scott. You don't have to tear your hair out over it. Just save it in a good quality .mov file, the best quality you can from QuickTime. Upload it to Vimeo. It'll take a while to upload because it's going to be a ginormous file. But they'll do the proper conversions. Look, these guys have been doing this for years. They've got automatic importers to do this.
Okay. Appreciate it.
And my pleasure, Scott. You know, sometimes people want to embed the video. If they make a video, they want to embed it and host it on their own thing. But why would you want to host it? Let these guys, they'll host it. And they got all the converters. They've really got a lot of experience doing this. So let them do it. I think Vimeo is a great site. And whenever I have high quality video that I want to share, high def video that I want to share, I will absolutely use Vimeo. My Vimeo account... In fact, if you want to see some stuff, let's see, I guess it's Leo Laporte. So it wasn't very expensive to create a pro account. It's not a complicated thing to do. And then you go to your account and you press the embed button, it'll give you the embed code. It'll give you a preview. You can customize the embed options so you can change the size. You can change how the player looks. You can see what the intro looks like. You can have it autoplay. You can have it loop. You could have a text link below the video. There's so many nice things that you can do. Yeah, it'll have a little Vimeo branding on it, but that's minor. Not bad at all. This would be my preference, even more than YouTube. YouTube is great. If you're looking to build a community around your video, YouTube's great. But if you just want something that makes it easy for you to put video on your website and have everybody, you know, and their sister and brother play it, that's a good choice. 8888 Ask Leo. Now, I said I was going to move fast, and did I? No. Sorry. I'll talk to more of you right after this. 8888 Ask Leo.
We built this city on rock and roll. Built this city.
Love this song.
We built this city on rock and roll.
Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888 Ask Leo. That's my number. If you like the music Kyle Benham picks, you can find a link to that on our show notes at the end of the show. Of course, we got to wait till the show's over. TechGuyLabs.com. Brian is in Abilene, Texas. Hey, Brian. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hey, Leo. Thanks for taking the call, buddy. Just a question. I know iPhone 5 is supposed to be coming out very soon. You're my first stop on the research trail, if you will. what would you suggest as far as purchasing the iPhone 5 versus something else, maybe with an Android system?
It's a great question. I'm waiting to see the iPhone 5 or 4S. We're not sure what they're going to call it. I have it on good authority, people who seem to know what they're talking about, including Kara Swisher of All Things D, that it will be October, about a month from now, that Apple will ship that new phone. We don't know what it will include, but best guess includes a faster processor, the A5, which is in the iPad. That's a dual-core processor. That should make a big difference. An 8-megapixel camera instead of the 5-megapixel. Already, Apple has in the iPhone 4 the best camera phone out by far. So if they improve on that, boy, I'll be happy. That'll make it even better. And, of course, they have the best application infrastructure. They have well over 250,000 applications available for the iPhone ecosystem, and I think that's a lot to be said for that. They're pretty much anything you want to do with a phone, the iPhone can do. However, it's Apple's world, and Apple controls it very tightly. And for some, that control chafes a little bit. I happen to like something where I can mess with it a little bit more, and so I do use Android phones. But it's a geekier thing. So it's almost like Windows versus Macintosh in the desktop computer days, where you'd get a Mac if you wanted something that was cleaner, simpler, more elegant, more expensive. In this case, no, because all the smartphones cost the same amount, roughly. And you'd get Windows if you wanted to be able to, mess around with them more. And that's really true of Android. I don't buy, occasionally you'll hear somebody say, like my friend Paul Thurrott, the host of our Windows Weekly podcast, that the Android is somehow less secure. I don't think that's the case. I think Android and iPhone, in many respects, are very, very similar.
Okay, so basically just go to the store, play with the phones, and see which one you like better.
Yeah, I mean, what do you have right now?
I have the iPhone 4 right now.
You like it?
I do. It does everything I want it to do. It's just sometimes it seems like it slows itself down, becomes bogged down sometimes.
Well, I'll tell you, that's something that the faster processor should absolutely fix. I suspect if you look, you'll see you've spent a little money on applications for the iPhone, right? You've added some apps?
Yes, sir.
Well, if you get an Android phone, none of that's coming with you, so you may have already invested your way into an iPhone future, just because if you want to keep those apps, you've already paid for them. And they'll migrate over to that new iPhone very easily and simply.
Okay.
So if you're happy with the bogged down thing, I wouldn't worry about. All smartphones can get bogged down if they're doing too much. These things aren't desktop computers.
Right.
But I think the new iPhone, because it will have it'll be twice as fast, is going to have fewer issues with that. And it has the advantage of you already know how to use it. You've already got applications for it. It'll be very simple. You'll take it home, you'll connect it to your computer, and boom, it's ready to go.
Okay.
A lot to be said for that.
And the expected cost on this thing?
No, we don't know. I mean, I can't imagine it'll be anything different. It'll be $200 if you don't have a... Are you Verizon or AT&T?
AT&T.
Yeah, it'll be... if you're at your two-year term on your existing iPhone, which you're probably not if you bought it when it came... the iPhone 4 when it came out, then you would get it for $200. But because it's been 18 months... or close to it, I think that AT&T will probably offer a discount to people who bought the iPhone 4. And I think the iPhone 4 is a great little phone. My biggest complaint with the iPhone 4 is it's fragile.
It is, yeah. Well, I've got the heavy-duty case on it.
Yeah, you
got
to wrap that puppy because it's made out of glass.
Yeah, that's
and right. As my friend Steve Martin said, it's not only made out of glass, it's slippery. I believe they will actually remedy that with iPhone 5. I think that they're going to have it will be a little more like an Android phone. It will probably not be glass on both sides, for instance.
Okay, awesome. Hey, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Brian. It is worth looking at Android, and certainly wouldn't hurt you to go to the AT&T store. And what I would look at if you're looking to compare apples to apples is AT&T has announced right about the same time frame, they'll have the Galaxy 2S, and that's a bigger screen. It's a Super AMOLED screen, which I think many people like better. Darker black's really beautiful screen. And it's going to be just as fast. It, you know, now Android has just as many applications. And in fact, Android, I think, has already eclipsed the iPhone in terms of number of users. So expect developers to continue to support Android phones. I think Android's caught up for all intents and purposes. But you got to really try it and see if you like it. That's really the question. There is no more personal computer than your phone, your smartphone. It's in your pocket. It's with you day in, day out. You're looking at it, and when you hold it, you hold it right up close. So you really do want to make sure it's something that you like the look and feel, and you're comfortable with it. And that's just a personal decision I can't make for you. If you haven't used Android and you have been using the iPhone, I think you probably should stick with the iPhone because I think you'll be a little disappointed with some of the fit and finish on the Android and the Android apps. Having said that, I'm Android all the way because I like to hack it and root it and play with it and set it and have different desktops and have, you know, I have the weather forecast and the background stuff I can't do on the iPhone. I love that. But I'm a geek. Charlene, Westlake Village, California. You're next. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi, Leo.
Hi, Charlene.
Leo, I'm having AT&T, speaking of AT&T, I'm having UVerse installed this week.
Oh, how exciting.
Well, okay.
You don't sound excited.
I'll tell you the truth. The only reason I'm having it done is because I currently have Time Warner Cable, and they provide the cable for my TV. And for some reason or other, ever since they took over this cable area here, I've had nothing but problems with the TV. It pixelates or tiles, whatever they call it. The sound cuts in and out. And they've done whatever they can here, and it's still happening.
I think it sounds like it's time to move. I agree with you.
I bought a new TV, and it's still doing the same.
Yeah, that's their problem, and they can't fix it. I think you should get a better provider.
Okay, so here's the situation. I was telling my son-in-law about this. And he said, well, you know, AT&T just installed fiber optics across the street from me. I saw them working. And he said to me, well, they have it in the street, but they have to bring it to the building.
That's right.
And if they haven't brought it to the building, they're only going to connect fiber optics to the old cables, and you're going to still have the same problem. Now,
No, that's not true, because Time Warner was via cable television. They don't have access to those cables. AT&T will use its phone cables if they don't want to bring fiber to your house.
Oh, I see.
So it will not be the same problem. It may be other problems, but it will not be the same problem. It's a different, completely different copper. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. So actually, it's very handy because I have somebody in studio with me who actually has AT&T UVerse. Carrie, right? Carrie's here with his poor, long-suffering wife. Fortunately, she has a smartphone. She's having fun anyway. He stole the iPad, I noticed. Did he steal your iPad, or you still have one? Oh, good. Okay. She's got something to do. Carrie, anyway, has UVerse. He says, if UVerse may well bring the data, whether it's fiber or copper over phone lines, to the, you know, garage, to the phone drop. And then if you have a cable system in your house, they'll just hook it up to that. So it's easy for you. Your cable TV's already hooked up. Of course, they'll replace your Time Warner box with a UVerse box, which he says, by the way, is very good. He likes a lot. So it's true for our last caller. If it were internal cable problems that you were having, that Time Warner was having, that those might be duplicated. But I don't think that's the case. It's very, very easy for a cable company to come to your house, see what kind of signal you're getting at the curb. See if you're getting the same signal at the TV. If there's a problem there, just run new cable. They say, oh, the internal cabling's bad, and they'd replace that. That's cheap and easy to fix. Much more likely what Time Warner was suffering is a problem in that neighborhood in general. You know, just a bad head end, or they didn't have enough connectivity, or, well, there are a variety of possibilities. Their cable infrastructure, external infrastructure, wasn't good. So I don't think you're going to have that same problem with UVerse. But if you do, then you know now, well, it's the cable wiring, but that's easy to fix, cheap. It's just coax cable. You just run fresh coax and you'd be fine. You know, maybe a rat chewed through it or something like that. So I don't think that's the same problem. I'd be very interested to see if the fiber optic, which is in your neighborhood, it's across the street, that's good news. They may well bring it to the house. It's cost them a little money. But they might well bring it to the house, which would give you even more reliability and bandwidth. I think it's worth a try. if Time Warner, if your local company's done everything they can and they cannot get it to work, and they throw their hands up, well, then it's time to shift. Unfortunately, we don't have true competition, do we? Not among internet service providers, not among TV providers. Usually, it's the for internet service, it's the phone company or the cable company. For TV, you might have a cable company and a satellite company to choose from. Now, thanks to UVerse and Fios from Verizon, we are starting to see the phone company step up with television choices. But it's still, at best, you might have two or three choices, at best. Which means, frankly, these companies don't have to care. Time Warner probably has the same problem you're having with everybody in their neighborhood. But they just figure, well, where are they going to go? We own those people. Where are they gonna, what are they going to do? It's like, remember the Lily Tomlin bit? She played, what was her name? Francine, the phone operator? She played the phone operator. We don't care. We don't have to. We're the phone company. They're still the phone company. Ernestine. Thank you, Steve. Steve B. in our chat room. Ernestine, the operator. That was a great bit. John in Westwood, California. Hi, John. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hello, Leo.
Hello, John.
I messed up. I let my 932 expire, and I got a virus.
Oh! Oh, that hurts.
It does. I'm pretty much back to normal, almost, except I can't run my programs from the start menu. I know they're still there because I go to the control panel, the add or remove programs, and they still show up in the list, but I can't run them. I go to all programs, and they just don't
show up. I think it sounds like the virus that you got is that blackmail virus where it basically keeps your system from running properly, and they said, but we can, for a small fee, we could fix that, usually $79. And that's what this bad stuff does, is it locks your system down. It's a really evil form of blackmail. When you say you fixed it, how did you do that?
I had a friend who got some, what's it called? He got something.
Malware bites.
That's what it is. Exactly what it is.
Yeah, that's what all the geeks use. Malware bites is good. I don't have anything against malware bites, but as you're discovering, it's not enough often. So what happens when you get once you get malware on your system, you're really kind of in bad shape because that malware not only infects your system in every way they can think of, and they don't want you to remove it, so they really work hard to dig deep down in there. They often open up ports on your system and invite other malware on there. So malware bytes may fix one issue, but may not fix it completely, as in your case, or may miss entirely other issues. There are things called rootkits that hide from any normal program. You have to have a rootkit remover. There's all sorts of things. Unfortunately, I hate to tell you this, John. This is really the bad news, and I don't like to be the bearer of bad tidings, but it's the fact. Once, and this is why, folks, it's so important you keep your system clean. Once you're infected, the only safe, sure, and reliable way to restore it so that you don't that you know with as much certainty as anyone can ever have that nothing bad is on your system watching your passwords, transmitting your credit card numbers to Moldova or somewhere. The only way to be sure of that is to get ready, get those system recovery disks that the computer came with or your Windows installer disk. Back up your data. You got to back that up, of course. Put it on an external hard drive. Then format the drive, wipe it clean, and reinstall Windows. Now, once you've reinstalled, I mean from a known good source, that means a Windows install disk or a, you know, a Dell branded or whatever company computer you have branded recovery disk, you've got to get that back to the way it was when it came from the factory, then apply all the system updates because you've got to make sure every one of those things is patched. So get online and the first thing you do is you go to Microsoft's Windows Update and you update and update till there's no more to update. Then you can reinstall your apps. Hope you have all the disks. Then you can restore your data. But before you do, I want you to renew NOD 32 and scan the heck out of that data disk, that backup data disk. Make sure you didn't back up any viruses along with it. And then you can restore the data. Then you're back to normal. And at that point, my strong suggestion is make an image of that hard drive. It's all set up. It's clean. It's updated. You got your data. You know it's good. That image you can burn onto a CD or a DVD, probably a DVD or a number of DVDs, or keep on a hard drive. That image is going to be a known good copy for the next time this happens, should it ever happen again. And then it'll be much faster to at least get to the point you are right now. In effect, you're making your own system recovery disks. Lots of good programs for making those. There's drivesnapshot.de. They're really good. There's Drive Image X. That's the one Steve Gibson likes these days. EaseUS, EaseUS.com makes a free backup program that will make a bootable image. And if you're sitting there right now on this fine Sunday afternoon and you're listening to the Tech Guy show and you're kind of relaxed, enjoying life on a Labor Day weekend, and maybe you're thinking, boy, I feel so sorry for that guy. I hope that doesn't ever happen to me. Maybe this would be a good time for you to do a little prophylaxis. Two things every Windows user should have: a boot disk with some tools on it, an emergency boot disk. There are a number of really good ones, some free emergency boot disk, so that you can boot up again if something bad happens to your hard drive, and a image snapshot of your known good operating system programs and data, all of that, and have that around. From now on, you'll continue to back up so you can quickly get up to date. I'm sorry, John. There is no shortcut, unfortunately. That's really what I'm saying. There's no shortcut to fixing your system. You have to start from scratch. Kevin in Toronto, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, Leo. How are you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
Not too bad, brother. Your new studio looks awesome.
Yeah, you're taking a look around. We have the live stream. If you haven't seen it, is on twit.tv. You can see what a beauty. I know. We love this place. You got to come visit it. Come down from Toronto.
Yeah, I probably will. I've been looking forward to doing that for a while now.
Would love to see you. Kevin, hang on because I have to take a break. I will be back, though. Don't go away, okay? Leo Laporte, the tech guy. More to come right after this. All right, Kyle. There ain't no bugs on me, says Kyle. Obviously, he's using Odd32 antivirus. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888. Ask Leo. That's the phone number if you've got a question, comment, suggestion. Last segment of the Tech Guy program here. We were talking before the break with Kevin in Toronto. And I'm sorry we got cut off. We ran out of time in that segment, but I've got some time for you now, Kevin. What can I do for you?
Sure, brother. I got a question about, what do you call this, studio monitor speakers.
Okay. For your computer?
Yes.
Yeah. So you're saying I want good speakers for my computer?
Pretty much, yes.
What's your budget?
Has to be less than $300.
Oh, yeah. There's some very good choices at under $300 for speakers. Do you want a really good bass? Is that important to you or not?
Yes, but it's more about the clarity for me.
Yeah. I bought, and I was very happy with these Orbs speakers. They're under $300 if you don't get a subwoofer. Let me see if I can. They're too tightly connected. They're really nice. Without a subwoofer, not heavy bass, but very good quality. Bose makes excellent speakers for computers. I'm very happy with the Bose speakers. Even Logitech makes decent speakers, believe it or not, because they bought Cambridge Soundworks, which was an excellent computer speaker company. So I think there are some excellent choices out there. I also use, and I don't know if they're in your budget, but I'm very happy with, and in fact, my son was looking for a really good sound system because he composes music, the Audio Engine speakers. So you go to audioengine.com. I have a set of these on my home theater, and he has a set upstairs, and he bought the subwoofer as well. And I think the quality is just excellent. Now, in all cases, everything I just mentioned, these are powered speakers. That means that you don't need a separate amp, that you plug these into your computer, and they have their own amp built in, so they're loud and clear. The Audio Engine 5, which is their top-of-the-line bookshelf speakers, are $350, so they're just a little more than your price range. I would say the best quality at that price you're going to get. You can get their Audio Engine 2s. Those are a little bit less expensive. They're $200. They're kind of small. I have those downstairs as well. I would recommend a subwoofer with these. But if you just want a great pair of stereo speakers, you said clarity is important, quality, $350, Audio Engine 5 would be, that's what I use. Let's put it that way. And I have had access to almost every kind of computer speaker made and been very happy with those. Charles, Fontana, California, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Charles.
Hi, Leo. How are you?
I'm great.
My son has a 17-inch Gateway laptop that got dropped.
Oh, dear.
After it got dropped, it no longer shows on the display on the laptop.
Okay.
I connected an external monitor to it, hoping that would solve the problem.
Yeah.
When you start the computer, you see the startup functions on the external monitor.
Yeah.
Once the computer's booted up, you can't see anything on the external monitor other than the mouse cursor.
Yeah, that's interesting. Had you ever tried an external monitor before the computer got dropped?
No.
It sounds to me like, here's what happened. When the computer got dropped, the internal screen either broke or the cable connecting the internal screen broke. If the screen itself broke, you can tell when an LCD screen's broken. It looks like it's broken. So if the LCD screen looks fine, even if you show it in daylight and you really look at it, it looks fine. Maybe the screen's okay. Maybe the backlight got broken, by the way. If you can shine it in daylight and you can kind of see the screen, then the backlight got broken. It could be the cable that's connecting it to the computer got broken. That's why the screen on the laptop is broken. You did a smart thing. You connect an external monitor. That should work fine. My suspicion is that the external monitor is working fine, but that the Windows settings are not proper. For instance, you're not mirroring. What you want is mirroring the internal video to the external video. If you use extended desktop, that's the other setting, then you'll have, in effect, two screens. The screen on the computer will have the menus and the icons, and the other screen, the black screen, probably is just his desktop with a mouse. So probably what your best bet would be to boot into safe mode. Hold down the shift key or tap the F8 key when you reboot the system. And I think in safe mode, you should be able to see that external monitor. If you can, all's well. It's just a broken internal monitor. Set those settings for the external monitor to be mirrored, not extended desktop, and all should be well. All right. Zach in Washington, D.C. Hey, is it Washington State or Washington, D.C.?
Washington State.
Hey, Zach.
Hey, quick question.
Yes.
We all know that the iPods and iPads have been big in sales. Just curious that we all know that Amazon has rolled out the Amazon MP3 store and the bookstore and also the app store.
Yeah, look what Amazon's doing. Are they getting ready for a tablet or what? They're selling Android apps in their own store. They've got a music service. They're absolutely getting ready for their tablet. And M.G. Siegler, my friend M.G. Siegler, who writes for TechCrunch, he just wrote an article saying Amazon's Kindle tablet is very real. I've played with it. It's a 7-inch tablet, be out sometime in the next month or so. It is thought that one of the ways this will be competitive is price. It is believed, now we don't know, but it's believed that Amazon will charge $250 for this. That's half what Apple charges for its iPad. It'll be a Kindle. It'll have Amazon Music on it. It will have the Amazon App Store. He says Amazon's completely rewritten the Android interface. You know, one complaint people have about Android is it's kind of a clunky interface. He says Amazon has completely rewritten this interface. He says it's very elegant. If you go to techcrunch.com, he wrote this article Friday, Amazon, just search for Amazon's Kindle tablet is very real. And you can read M.G. Siegler's hands-on report. And he was pretty impressed. He says it looks a lot like the BlackBerry Playbook. And that's one thing I would say about Amazon. Their hardware design is not exactly elegant. I mean, if you've seen the Kindle, the Kindle's great, but it isn't a work of art. It's not beautiful. It's very functional, right? Kind of clunky. But you don't buy it, you know, for its beauty. It's not like an iPad that you buy because it's beautiful. You buy it for what it'll do. This is going to be a very hot product. All the rumors are that Amazon's cranking out millions of these things. They're going to be very aggressive at pricing. They have an app store. They have Kindle. I think this is going to be a very interesting product and something to pay attention to. Is it going to be an iPad killer? No way. Apple owns this market. The iPad is amazing. It's elegant. It's fast. I misstated last time, last hour. I said there were 250,000 apps. There's more than 400,000 apps. So there's a great variety of stuff. Now, not all those apps take advantage of the real estate, but I can't remember what it is, but there's something like 100,000 iPad-specific apps. So I don't think that Amazon succeeds by beating the Kindle. I think they succeed by undercutting the Kindle, or not the Kindle, the iPad, and providing a ecosystem much like Apple's ecosystem. You know, one of the reasons Apple succeeds is because it's all there. They've got the iBooks. They've got the iTunes. They've got the iApps. It's all a closed ecosystem. It syncs to your computer. It's very easy, very elegant. I think Amazon is watching this very closely, and I would not count them out. They're smart. They're very smart. So I think this will be a very competitive product. Will it be the one you want? I don't know. Are you looking at it to buy it, Zach, or you just want to know more about it?
That was it.
Huh? That's what I know. That's it. I'll tell you what, I'm out of time. But that's all? Yeah, that's all, Zach. Thanks for joining me. I'll see you next time. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy.